now it's time for you to ask Morrows.
Don't you think it's time to ask Morrows? Well, now is the time. We'll be taking your tricky legal questions on the last Thursday of every month at 7:30 a.m. Send us a voice note now to our dedicated number, 067-622-469. Or click our link on our Facebook page. Ask Morrows. Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. And in the studio with me right now, we've got Sean Morrow from Morrow's to answer your tricky legal questions. It is the last Thursday of the month. And Sean, welcome to you. I believe happy birthday is in order. Yesterday was a birthday. Am I right?
It was indeed. I could avoid that question quite easily, getting a bit older. Thanks for that.
Well, I'm excited that you made it into the studio this morning. You know how birthday celebrations can go.
Yeah, staggering past Micah was not my best feat.
Okay, luckily it's radio. No one has to see it. And you're sounding fresh. That's all that matters.
I am rocking and ready.
Ready to answer some tricky legal questions. And we've got quite a mix of questions that have come through on the hotline this morning. A couple in the sort of property, residential space, and some that are a bit more generalized. Are you ready to crack open? Have you been sort of impressed with the caliber of questions that have come in?
Definitely. We are up a grade. Let's unravel that. That's a special present for me.
It is. For your birthday. We knew it was going to be. But before we do actually get into the nitty-gritty and answer these questions, for those that have heard the name Morrows but are wondering what area of legal stuff you specialize in, it's everything, really. I mean, what is Morrows all about?
It is everything, and we try and be everything. I have to kind of clarify that we don't want to be a jack of all trades. We want to be a master of all.
There you go.
So, exciting stuff. We are at the moment a regional law firm, and we do a lot of conveyancing work. We're specialist conveyancers. We do the ceased estates and wills and trusts, so a lot of fiduciary law. We stretch from Richards Bay office in the north to Umhlanga in the south and Ballito, yeah. And there's a prospect of another region coming up soon.
Whoa.
Talks of the big G, Gauteng, is up and coming.
Wow. Watch the space. Well, keep your ear to the radio.
Yes, that's the idea. You heard it on 88.
Exclusive scoop, man.
That's it.
So you're getting the picture. Morrows has all of the legal expertise to answer any legal question you can throw at them. That's why we're doing this. This Ask Morrows, chance for you to get some free expert legal advice on any tricky legal question. And just starting off, I've got a little voice note here that I want to play to see if we've got an answer to provide. Here we go. Oh, hang on a second. If I can get my WhatsApp machine to play, this should work. Here we go.
Hi, 88FM. I have a question for you. If I put in an offer on a home and I change my mind, will I be liable for any costs? I hope you can help me.
Okay. That's obviously quite a relevant question in the times that we're in. I think a lot of people might have been feeling a bit bolder on the purchasing front and then maybe had a change of heart or a U-turn or a change of financial situation.
So that's kind of a deep question, and I think it's becoming quite prevalent. I think interest rates and build quality and things like that go into play, but there's some basic legal principles that one needs to answer. So to answer it, the simple question is yes, there are costs, but we need to break it down. The first thing is it's an offer, so an offer by itself is revocable, and that means we have to look at what constitutes an offer. So we have to look at a few presumptions here. The first presumption is that the offer must be in writing. So in our country, you can't make an offer on immovable property verbally, so it has to be in writing.
Okay.
So that's the first aspect.
So a handshake and my word isn't strong enough.
No, it's not the 70s anymore, guys. The second presumption is that the offer must have been accepted by the seller, also in writing. So that means they can't just give you a call and say, yeah, I'll accept your offer, and then everyone goes to the bank and transfers the money.
So you need that paper trail or that email correspondence as proof.
100%, yeah. That's it. And then we need to look at how it changes here. So here we have an offer, and the offer changes once accepted in writing to a sale agreement, and now it becomes a binding contract. So let's break it down. In the case that the offer has not been accepted, it can be revoked by the person making the offer. Okay. Right? And it's usually in lieu of a purchase period, like an acceptance period. So when you make an offer, you have a few days to give the seller time to consider your offer. If you revoke, it has to be in that timeline.
Okay. And is there sort of a standard rule of thumb window period?
Yeah, look, anywhere up to a week is acceptable. You know, some people are under pressure as a seller, so 3 or 4 days, you know, depending over a weekend. But 7 days is a reasonable accepting offer, a timeline. And then the other concept that needs to be considered is that the wording must not have irrevocable in it. So you can't say, I make an irrevocable offer that must be accepted within 7 days and then revoke it 3 days later.
You shoot yourself in the foot with that one, yeah.
Wording is important. Okay, so the next issue at hand is, if you've made an offer and it is accepted and you have capacity. Now, capacity is an important concept in law. It's kind of like law 101. You can't say, well, I'm going to make an offer to buy a property and you're 12 years old. You've got no legal capacity. Or you have been admitted to a mental institution for having no legal capacity. You need to have legal capacity to enter into the agreement. So that needs to be out of the way. But if you have and the seller has accepted it, then in this case, the answer is yes, you've got some costs to worry about. And it gets into a bit of meat.
Oh.
So, cancellation of a contract is basically your outcome unless it's specified otherwise in the contract. So unless there is an exit clause, then you'll be liable for damages. And most offer to purchases, when they become a sale agreement, have got a damages clause in them.
Ooh.
Okay, so I'm going to skip all the complex legal processes here and get to the summary, which basically answers what is the person going to have to pay for if they cancel that sale. And there's basically four, defined or main costs that they'll have to pay for. The one is, and most obvious, which is the property practitioner's commission. That's the estate agent's commission.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, they'll be liable for all the legal fees, but it's the legal fees for work done up to date.
Okay.
Okay, and that is basically, you've got a transferring attorney to transfer the property. They may have done some work. You've got a bond registration attorney that might have done work. So if you're taking out a bond, they'll bill you for that. And then in the event it's quite far down the line, you'll have a bond cancellation attorney who's canceling the seller's bond. They may have a fee to pay for as well.
Yeah, so it can add up.
It can add up. And those fees are not cheap, justified, but not cheap. And then the next amount that they'll have to pay for is any disbursement. So anything that the attorneys have paid for to fulfill the contract, they'll have to recover from the party that cancels, in this case being the person that made the offer, which could be anything from certificate fees to any pro rata rates, whatever it might be.
Okay.
So it does add up. And then fourthly, the biggest cost is the damages for the seller, and that's not easily quantifiable. And so I like to draw a little bit of a story or analogy here. Let's say you do make an offer, you cancel the sale, and the seller says, well, listen, you can't cancel, and you do. And that seller is forced to put it back on the market and resells, and they sell it for less than what you made an offer for after they've made sufficient effort to market the property. That difference in the purchase price they can claim, because that's their loss.
Whoa.
Yeah, and any incidental costs. So they might end up having to pay to have the property recleaned, or they might have to pay for another property practitioner. So the bill can run extensively high.
Sure. So if you have committed and you've made the offer in writing and it has been accepted, and you're having second thoughts, getting cold feet, think long and hard.
Yeah, it's a lifelong commitment. I mean, or rather, it's a generation-long commitment. I mean, your bond is 20 years, 30 years. You're making a major life change, and there's serious ramifications, because there's another entire entity, party, family involved that's being disrupted by it. They're obviously not going to take it lightly.
No, and it could end up being a really costly exercise, and you've got to sort of weigh that up. You know, there was obviously a reason why you were keen on pursuing it in the first place, and is it going to be worth backing out at this stage?
So one thing I want to touch on is misrepresentation, and it ends up being a bit of a gray area with regards to cancellation of a sale. But in the event that you've made the offer and now you want to cancel your offer or revoke your offer on the basis that the seller or the property practitioner has somehow misrepresented the property, but materially, that means substantially, you may have grounds to cancel. But it's on a case-by-case basis. Let's take a silly example, and it's unfortunately ignorance that brings this into play. You view a property online, and it's listed as a 3-bedroom property.
Yeah.
And you make an offer subject to view, and you're happy with the price. It sounds like a deal, and you send the thing via email or courier so that you can get something binding. and you find out that the third bedroom's actually a small little walk-in closet that they've converted into a single bed space, and it doesn't suit the needs. So it doesn't really define a third bedroom, and you now say, listen, well, you've materially misrepresented me. If you've waived that clause that says it's subject to viewing because you thought you really got the right deal, photographs might be a bit misleading. In that case, if there has been a material misrepresentation, then you will be able to get out of the contract because you're not buying what you intended to buy or what you were believed to understand is the product.
So is an example where, for that particular case, there are factors at play there, and you would be well advised to be engaging with the services of a legal professional who can navigate the intricacies of your particular case to see if there is merit, if there is actually some legitimate reason for you to back out without being slapped with all of these costs.
Definitely see a professional and don't become a Google lawyer. They don't know anything.
And if you're going to be asking someone, well, come on, ask Morrows.
We are right, yeah.
Before we hit a quick little musical break, I've got one more little question that's coming on the hotline that I wanted to throw your way. This one also concerning a residence, but more concerning an irritating neighbor. And I think this is probably something that few people will be able to relate to in Balito when load shedding does strike. Let's see what this person has to say.
Hi, my question for Ask Morrow is, my neighbor runs a generator during load shedding that is noisy and very smoky. Can I take legal action?
Okay, and this is something I've heard people complaining about this before, in passing. Is there a legal case here?
So there's not really a tested precedent that can deal with a noisy or a smoky generator, but there are standards that people have to maintain. And based on a recent test in the Western Cape, most small generators are automatically above noise levels. So the first thing we need to look at is what are the noise levels that are prohibited. And each municipality has a different threshold, but it's normally between 65 and 70 decibels. So on the noise level basis, you're going to have a problem because your most small generators are used to run a few lights or a few appliances, and no one is really running a whole household on a generator. So you're always going to be in that infringement kind of area. The problem is that we've established is that when people run generators, they move the generator as far away from home as possible so that they're not affected by those things.
Closer to the neighbor's wall.
The neighbor ends up enjoying lovely noise. So the basic answer to that question is, yes, you can take legal action. Whether it's going to be enforceable in court is another question. That's discretion from a magistrate. And because it's a contentious issue because of our power grid being so unstable and load shedding becomes something that's not a state of emergency, but it's almost a state of urgency in our country that you need to survive. Mm. Whether or not they'll award in favor of having the generator switched off permanently is another question. However, most local municipalities have got a policy or a bylaw dealing with it. And if you do report it to the municipality and it is excessive, they will automatically ask you to switch the generator off until they've deemed whether it is compliant or not. Regarding the smoky nature of it, most generators are petrol or diesel. They don't have any other chemicals that they use. And unless it hasn't been serviced and it's got high oil and pollution levels, it should be acceptable. So it's the condition of the generator that's going to matter. And like I said, if the positioning of it is causing a direct disturbance to your neighbor, then it's something that you should take seriously and move out of the way. I wouldn't recommend going the legal route because it's just going to create disturbance with your neighbor. Your relationship's gonna break down. And in a time of need, we need to rely on our community. And that's really something that Morrows is focused on, building a community. I would say, listen, have a chat. Move the generator. Can't you just relocate it? Move it on the other side where you might not have a neighbor or consider an amicable solution.
Be reasonable. Come on.
Be reasonable. Don't take this to a lawyer, guys. Seriously.
Unless you really have a neighbor who is just completely one of those unsavory people.
A 30-year-old generator that hasn't been serviced but is somehow still running.
they exist, man.
They do.
You're getting the perspective here, the legal perspective from Sean Morrow, and we're going to be asking Morrows a few more on the other side of